A note. I recorded this episode while on the road at the International Congress on Medieval Studies at Western Michigan University, so there's more reverb than usual, and you might hear the occasional noise of human activity in the conference dormitory in the background. Doors, footsteps, though I think I at least removed the occasional distant toilet flush. This is Medieval Death Trip for Sunday, May 12th, 2024, episode 106, concerning the hard work of a housewife. Hello and welcome to Medieval Death Trip, the show where we explore the wit and weirdness of medieval texts. I'm your host, Patrick Lane. Today is Mother's Day, or at least it's the single most widely observed date for Mother's Day. Some countries, of course, opt for different dates. I ran down the modern history of Mother's Day back in our Father's Day episode from 2021, episode 88, concerning the plight of the paterfamilias, and it is very much a modern holiday, conceived in the 20th century. One of those other dates for Mother's Day, Mothering Sunday, as observed in the British Isles on the fourth Sunday in Lent, which was March 10th of this year, does link back to the Middle Ages, though through a metaphor of motherhood. The liturgical readings for the fourth Sunday in Lent include Galatians chapter 4, verses 21 through 31, which include reference to Jerusalem being, quote, our mother, end quote, and from that, it became a medieval practice to honor and make a procession to one's mother church, typically your local cathedral, on the fourth Lenten Sunday. From this honoring of mother churches, the honoring of human mothers was assigned to this day in the early 20th century when Englishwoman Constance Adelaide Smith decided that the United Kingdom needed its own version of the then recently enshrined American Mother's Day. So the medieval connection is a bit loose for Mothering Sunday, and even if you go looking among saints' feast days, there's not very strong evidence for any specific date of the celebration of motherhood in the Middle Ages. Obviously, many celebrations of the Virgin Mary involve recognition of the sanctity of motherhood, but rarely do human mothers steal the spotlight from the Holy Mother, as near as I can tell. And other than Mary, there isn't any one clear patron saint of mothers to look to for promising feast day traditions. There are lots of fertility-related saints, who sometimes have feasts involving quite peculiar customs, and there are several saints invoked for the protection of pregnant women. But actual day-to-day motherhood seems oddly underrepresented in saintly portfolios. You might call on Saint Anthony for help with conception, Saint Gerard for safe childbirth, or Saint Anne for healthy children or success in breastfeeding. It's almost as if women and mothers are primarily perceived in terms of the functions they perform for others. If you ask Google who the patron saint of mothers is, you'll get a confident answer of Saint Monica, the mother of Augustine of Hippo. The Catholic Encyclopedia doesn't specify her patronage portfolio, but her Wikipedia article gives an extensive list, and mothers, per se, isn't there. Married women is one of her domains, as well as difficult marriages, victims of adultery or unfaithfulness, and, amazingly, disappointing children. I did not know there was a patron saint of disappointing children, but I'm glad to know it now. I also see that some other authorities phrase it as wayward children, which perhaps sounds a bit less bizarre. But either way, if your parent ever gives you a Santa Monica medal, they just might be sending you a message. And while we're on the subject of odd commemorations, I want to dip back into Galatians chapter 4, the reading for Mothering Sunday. It's all well and good for Constance Adelaide Smith to look back to a practice of honoring mother churches that stems from one verse in that reading, but the larger context for this recognition of Mother Jerusalem really muddies the waters on honoring mothers. Here's the actual reading for that Sunday, known as the Allegory of Hagar and Sarah, as given in the New Revised Standard Version. Tell me, you who desire to be subject to the law, will you not listen to the law? For it is written that Abraham had two sons, one by an enslaved woman and the other by a free woman. One, the child of the enslaved woman, was born according to the flesh. The other, the child of the free woman, was born through the promise. Now this is an allegory. These women are two covenants. One woman, in fact, is Hagar from Mount Sinai, bearing children for slavery. Now Hagar is Mount Sinai in Arabia and corresponds to the present Jerusalem, for she is in slavery with her children. But the other woman corresponds to the Jerusalem above. She is free, and she is our mother. For it is written, "Rejoice, you childless one, you who bear no children. Burst into song and shout, you who endure no birth pangs, for the children of the desolate woman are more numerous than the children of the one who is married." Now you, my brothers and sisters, are children of the promise, like Isaac. But just as at that time the child who was born according to the flesh persecuted the child who was born according to the spirit, so it is now also. But what does Scripture say? "Drive out the enslaved woman and her child, for the child of the enslaved woman will not share the inheritance with the child of the free woman." So then, brothers and sisters, we are children not of an enslaved woman, but of the free woman. A little hard to take all that as a ringing endorsement of motherhood. Not to mention, it's this kind of rhetoric from the letters of Paul that was used to justify the persecution of Jews, the images of spiritual bondage and exile rather easily converting into quite material oppression, abuse, and segregation. It also figures into 19th century justifications for slavery, though the story of Hagar has a complicated position in attitudes towards slavery, as she is also an important emblematic figure and namesake for many enslaved people and abolitionists. But that story is well outside our scope. So let's shift over to our medieval text for today, a story about a marriage that could have used the intervention of St. Monica, as its title pretty strongly indicates. It's known as Ballad of a Tyrannical Husband, though as depicted, this husband seems less tyrant and more clueless chauvinist, not that the two are mutually exclusive. And also, despite its title, the main character, or at least the viewpoint character, seems more to be the wife rather than the husband, though I suppose it is actually the husband who undergoes a character arc and learns a lesson. Also, that's the title modern editors have given this text. In the sole manuscript that preserves it, it begins clearly separated from other texts by a blank page, but unlike some other items in this manuscript, which start with an incipit like, "Here beginneth the tale of so-and-so," this one just kicks off with its opening lines at the top of the page. No title provided. This is a poem in the English of the 1400s, which in terms of vocabulary and grammar is reasonably close to modern English. Now, spelling and pronunciation is something else entirely, but those features we can set aside for this reading. However, there's still just enough unusual vocabulary that if I parenthetically added the modern equivalent every time, the reading would get clunky and tedious. So, in the interest of accessibility, I'm going to silently make several replacements of archaic words with modern ones, and I'll just add in little glosses for words that are part of the rhyme scheme that would be more awkward to lose. And I'll do that for a few other words or phrases that are important for the cultural context, too. Also, since it's been a while since we've used it, let me clarify gloss. That's a bit of medievalist jargon, and it means to annotate a word with a definition. If you feel like you're missing out on the Middle English vocabulary, the original text is freely available online as part of the Teams Middle English Text volume, The Trials and Joys of Marriage, edited by Eve Salisbury. A link to that is on the episode post at our website, medievaldeathtrip.com. And before diving right into the text, I do want to do some pre-glossing of a handful of key words, along with a little discussion of some words specific to the work of our wife here. In fact, this is going to be a fairly extensive prologue on various word origins. Not long ago, the show got a review that criticized our too frequent digressions into word histories, and all I can say to that listener, if you're still a listener, is that you might want to skip ahead. And I am sensitive to the problem of the commentary overwhelming the actual texts, but with specific reference to linguistic digressions, I don't feel particularly compelled to apologize. Maybe word histories sometimes feel extraneous to the specific texts, but they are the kind of knowledge and scholarship that is so fundamental to the practice of medieval studies and to the practice and thought ways of medieval writers themselves that it should be part of the lifeblood of this show, I think anyway, and I make the show. So Also, if there were any special pleading, on this occasion I can at least say that it is appropriate for Mother's Day to explore the mother tongue. So first, let's talk about the wife. She is presented as a huswife, or housewife, practicing the art of housewifery. I think the meaning of housewife in modern perception and usage has taken on some baggage with the idea that a housewife, in contrast perhaps to other wives, is one who specifically stays at home, is a homemaker, where the house part of housewife is a key signifier. It was also a key signifier in Old and Middle English, but for a slightly different reason. We today might specify housewife as a married woman whose primary workplace is the house, but wif in Old English did not yet mean wife as we use it, but just meant woman. And while hus certainly did mean the physical structure of a residence, it also symbolically meant the household, so the housewife was the woman in charge of the household, just as its partner word, husband, husband, meant the bondi, the bondsman, the prime tenant of a landholding, in a household, or the male head of the household. And you do also find the form husbandman attested as well. Now, quite early on, these two words come to signify married woman and married man, even outside the context of tenant farming, and also by the start of Middle English, you are already finding wife taking on the meaning of married woman rather than just female person. But my main point here is just to highlight that for the audience of the poem, the word housewife more connoted the broad range of domestic responsibilities and management the woman of the house was expected to take on. Though, no doubt, those who have worked to reclaim the label housewife today are emphasizing that same breadth and range of activity against the old-fashioned sitcom stereotypes. And actually, this is also kind of what our ballad is trying to do as well, against medieval misogynist stereotypes of women's work. And what was some of that work? Well, I'll let the poem lay a lot of it out on its own, but there's one particular passage that is chock full of trade jargon that I'd have to explain even if I plugged in more modern terms. This is the vocabulary of spinning and cloth making. Here are the specific lines we'll need to just process ahead of time. The wife says, I beat and swingle flax as ever have I heel, I heckle the toe, I cave and I keel, I tooze wool and cart it and spin it on the wheel. So, beat and swingle is a phrase like whisk and stir, where you have a duplication of similar actions. She's doing two things to flax. Beating it, I don't need to define. To swingle is, per the Oxford English Dictionary, quote, to beat and scrape flax or hemp with a swingle in order to cleanse it of the coarser particles, end quote. And so, to define that, we have to go to the noun. The noun swingle is, quote, a wooden instrument resembling a sword used for beating and scraping flax, end quote. Swingle comes from the verb swing, which in its Old English and Middle English forms really just meant to flog, to beat, to scourge, and that is what you are doing to the flax with your swingle. Swing then also starts being used to describe sword blows, and that opens it up to encompass not just actually striking someone with a sword, but also drawing it and waving it around. The evolution isn't clear, but this kind of swinging could well lead to the meaning we most commonly use today, to move back and forth, which you don't really find until the 16th century. So, for all the noise they made, medieval bells didn't swing. They were struck, they rang, they chimed, they tolled, but I guess they didn't start swinging until the 1600s, linguistically speaking. Now, in medieval Dutch and German, cognates to swingle actually mean the clapper in a bell, though I'm guessing not so much because it swings back and forth, and more because it strikes and beats on the bell itself. And this usage even appears in English in the 1400s, but I can't find any citations of the verb swing being used to describe bells that early. But it does suggest a kind of etymological destiny shaping up. All right, why is the wife abusing this flax so? Well, here are the bare bones basics of how you get thread and cloth from flax. Flax is a flowering plant. To my inexperienced eyes, it looks like a kind of weedy tall wildflower with thin grassy leaves. The stalks can grow about 4 feet tall, or a bit over a meter, And that's great because inside those stalks are the fibers we want to make textiles from, so longer fibers, more to work with. You harvest your flax by uprooting it and then drying it out. Then you wet it again, either by submerging it or by leaving it exposed in humid conditions, with the goal of beginning to separate the valuable fibers from the other tissues of the plant. And the damp conditions basically cause those other parts to decompose and rot away, hence the name for this process, retting. Not rotting, but retting, though they are etymologically connected. And, as it happens, all those flax fibers are still pretty connected together even after the retting, and the next step is the process our housewife has just done. You beat and swingle the flax to begin breaking off the rest of that outer straw or husk and the inner pith so that only the fibers remain. But beating the flax still doesn't get you all the way there, so the next step is heckling it. To heckle, like swingle, is a verb derived from the name of a tool. A heckle, or hackle, is a comb that you repeatedly pull the beaten flax fibers through, removing even more of the chaff, as well as wads of coarser fibers, which are called tow. We'll come back to tow in a minute. But first, because the long feathers on the back of a rooster's neck resemble the teeth of this flax comb when they're raised up in a threat display, that part of the rooster is also called the hackle, or hackles, which is where we get our phrase, to get one's hackles up, meaning to show irritation. The flax comb also gives us heckler, one who interrupts a performer or someone making a speech. That originated as a description of asking badgering questions, especially of a politician, but has gradually expanded to more general disruptive behavior directed at a performer. And while getting heckled may get your hackles up, the etymology of heckler appears to go back not to angry roosters, but to the vigorous combing and teasing of the flax. It's a metaphor like being raked over the coals, or being teased for that matter, which goes back to the teasel, another fiber-working tool featured as an instrument of torture back in our episode 11, How a Blood Libel Takes Root. So, as you hackle the flax, you will be producing as a byproduct tow, this tangle of cast-off fibers used for making coarser fabric and other products. The typical light color of the tow gives us the adjective tow-headed, meaning fair-haired or blonde. It is also a word for rope, which could be made from tow fibers, and tow rope originates with flaxen tow. But the verb tow, as in tow truck, has an unrelated origin. It comes from the Old English togion, to tug or pull or haul, which becomes both tug and, by a dropping of the G sound, tow. And so you end up with a kind of etymological convergence, like we saw with gloss and glass way back in episode 33, where two words that sound alike begin to overlap in meaning as well. So is a tow rope a rope made of tow or a rope used for towing? Well, it can be both or either. So where are we in our process? She beats and swingles the flax, as ever has she heel or health. Then she heckles the tow, she caves and she keels. This pair is a bit of a problem, and I haven't come across a very satisfying answer among the scholars who have written about this ballad. Cave appears to be a variation on chave or chafe, which could mean to remove the chaff, which makes a lot of sense in the context of the flax preparation process and would be fine, except for the next word. Keel comes from Old English kaelan, to make cool. From Old English up to Elizabethan English, you had to keel as a verb and cool as an adjective, not unlike to heat as a verb and hot as an adjective. But by the end of early modern English, the verb and adjective forms had assimilated, with cool operating for both parts of speech. Now, in the context of cooling things down, we do find keel being used to mean to stir a pot to prevent it from boiling over. So you might say, I'm keeling or cooling the pot, meaning you're stirring it. However, physically cooling down the flax is not part of the standard process. But maybe it's the stirring image that's being evoked here, because the vaguely circular rhythmic motions of pulling a handful of flax through the hackle could maybe be described with the verb keel. But it feels like a stretch. And if we go back to chafe, the problem gets thornier, because another meaning for chafe is to make warm, as in chafing dish. Indeed, the idea of chafing as peeling or abrading goes back to rubbing something vigorously, which makes heat through friction. So, now, to cave and keel very neatly becomes to heat up and cool down. Which would be great, except that's not really something you'd be doing to your flax fibers after heckling, at least not in any of the descriptions of the process that I've read. But the task our housewife describes in the next line is preparing wool. And scouring wool in very hot water is a first step in getting wool ready for spinning. Again, cooling it down doesn't seem to be specifically mentioned in descriptions of wool prep, but you do have to dry it, and maybe that's what's being referred to. Or maybe we're back to stirring, and to keel is to stir the pot that you're scouring your wool in. Of course, we can always take the poetry escape hatch and say maybe it's all deliberate wordplay that's meant to work in all different directions and combinations. That might have felt like way too much time spent on reading two words, but this is an example of the kinds of questions modern readers of medieval texts have to work through. It's easy to pick up an edition with a footnote saying, this line means this, or a modernization that provides what appears to be the translation, and a casual reader can be forgiven for getting the impression that these are definitive answers. But quite often, they really aren't. Almost always, there is some margin of ambiguity, and rather than producing certainty in our interpretations, scholars are usually just hoping to narrow that margin enough to make one resolution to the ambiguity preferable to the others. It's a little unfortunate that many editors and translators don't make it clearer that their rendering is but one of a few options of varying plausibility. There is a tendency to present interpretations with an artificial certainty, which is really not that great a crime, because if you had to lay out all the ambiguities every time, you would never escape your footnotes. I know one of my rhetorical and intellectual vices is that I'm a bit allergic to certainty. I'm a real on the one hand, but on the other kind of guy. I can't shake adverbial phrases like a bit, somewhat, sort of, kind of, perhaps. If you made a drinking game of those for an episode, you'd be unconscious well before we got to the text. This is a tendency that has not exactly been a boon for my academic publishing career, but I think it's kind of important. See, there, kind of important. I think it's important. Do I? Probably. At least, I think there is a reasonable defense for it against being dismissed as a verbal tic or rhetorical bad habit. They aren't just filler words. Anyway, whatever is being caved and keeled in this poem, our housewife then tells us that she next tooses or teases and cards wool, which is the same kind of pulling the fibers through a comb process done on flax. And then finally, we get to the emblematic housewife activity, spinning your fibers on the wheel. Given all this skill, it should come as no surprise that one Middle English word used to describe our housewife is hend. Chaucer fans might recognize this adjective from the Miller's Tale, where the student lodging with the miller and trying to seduce his wife is called Hend Nicholas. It means clever, resourceful, skillful, handy, which is etymologically related. It can also more broadly mean virtuous, noble, good in a general kind of way. But for our housewife, I think capable, resourceful, maybe even sliding over to canny or wily are appropriate. We're very nearly done with our language lesson. We have three more words to cover that are more general purpose terms. The first two are basically still modern English. The first is meat, and the reminder here is that when a Middle English writer and many early modern writers say meat, they just mean food. Could be vegetables or grain. If they mean meat as we use it, they would say flesh, as our balladeer will. Our second word is wind, which means to go or to proceed, carry on. We still find it in modern English, mainly in poetic phrasing, like to wind one's way through life, etc. Its past tense form is much more common. It's went. Just as today I send an email and yesterday I sent one, today I wind and yesterday I went. There are more fun linguistic facts there about how and why we now use went as the past tense for go, but I'm sure I have already tested the patience of many of you for linguistic trivia, so let's wrap up with our final word. This one has not survived in modern English, but it's used several times in the poem, so I want to introduce it. It is wone, or wonus, which means dwelling place, or in the plural, rooms. Like To, you probably have a merging of two different words here. On the one hand, it seems to most directly derive from an Old Norse word, vaun, hope or expectation, and hence used to mean a place where one expects to find something, like a fishing spot or a hunting ground. So it seems to develop along a home is where the heart is kind of analogy. Home is where you hope to be, or less romantically, where one might expect to find you. There is also an Old English verb, wunion, that means to dwell, to inhabit. So even though the Middle English woon most likely starts as a borrowing of a Norse word, its close resemblance to a semantically similar English root reinforces its usage. But not that strongly, since woon really didn't survive past the 1500s. Though the verb, wonne, derived from the Old English, stuck around in Northern English and Scottish dialects up into the 19th century. And there is some evidence that our manuscript, or at least parts of it, were produced around Yorkshire, so maybe some northern linguistic connections would make sense. And on that note, it is finally time to present the text itself. So here is the so-called Ballad of a Tyrannical Husband, which opens with the singer's address to their audience. Jesu, that art gentle, for joy of thy dame, as thou wrought this wide world, in heaven is thy home. Save all this company and shield them from shame, that will listen to me and attend to this game. God keep all women that to this town belong, maidens, widows, and wives among, for much they are blamed, and sometime with wrong. I take witness of all folk that heareth this song. Listen, good sirs, both young and old, of a good husband this tale shall be told. He wedded a woman that was fair and bold, and had goods enough to wind as they would. She was a good housewife, courteous and hind, and he was an angry man, and soon would be tinned, or enraged, chiding and brawling, and fared like a fiend, as they that often will be wroth with their best friend. Till it befell upon a day, short tale to make, the goodman would to the plow, his horse gan he take. He called forth his oxen, the white and the black, and he said, "Dame, make our dinner betime, for God's sake." The goodman and his lad to the plow be gone. The good wife had much to do, and servant had she none. Many small children to keep besides herself alone, she did more than she might within her own woon. Home come the goodman, be time of the day, to look that all thing were according to his pay, or pleasure. "Dame," he said, "is our dinner made?" "Sir," she said, "nay, how would you have me do more than I can?" Then he began to chide and said, "Evil mut thou thee, or evil may you suffer. I would thou shouldst all day go to the plow with me, to walk in the clots that be wet and marshy. Then shouldst thou wit what it were a plowman to be." Then swore the good wife, and thus gan she say, "I have more to do than I may. And ye should follow me fully one day. Ye would be weary of your part, my head dare I lay, or I bet my head on it." "Weary, in the devil's name," said the goodman, "what hast thou to do but sits here at home? Thou goest to thy neighbor's house again and again, and sits there jangling with Jake and with John." Then said the good wife, "Fair must you fail. I have more to do, whoso knew all. When I lie in my bed, my sleep is but small, yet early in the morning ye will me upcall. When I lie all night waking with our child, I rise up at morrow and find our house wild. Then I milk our kine and turn them on the field, while you sleep full still, so Christ me shield. Then make I butter further on the day, after make I cheese. These hold you a play? Then will our children weep at the utmost they, yet will you blame me for our good if any be away or missing. When I have so done, yet there comes more e'en, or still. I give our chickens meat, or else they will be lean, our hens, our capons, our ducks bodine, or together, while I tend to our goslings that goeth on the green. I bake, I brew, it will not else be well. I beat and swingle flax, as ever have I health. I heckle the toe, I cave and I keel, I tease wool and card it and spin it on the wheel. Dame, said the goodman, the devil have thy bones. Thou needest not bake nor brew in fortnight past once, or more than once a fortnight. I see no good thou dost within these wide wones, but ever thou excusest thee with grunts and groans. Said she, either I make a piece of linen and wool once a year, for to clothe ourselves and our children together, else we should go to the market and buy it full dear. I am as busy as I may in every year. When I have so done, I look on the sun, that is, I see the dawn breaking. I ordain meat for our beasts before you come home, and meat for ourselves before it be noon. Yet I have not a fair word when that I have done. So I look to our good without and within, that there be none away, neither more nor men, or more or less. Glad to please you to pay, lest any debate begin, or quarrel. And for to chide thus with me, I think you be in sin. Then said the goodman, in a sorry time, all this would a good housewife do long ere it were prime, or 6 a.m. And since the good that we have is half deal thine, or half of it is yours, thou shalt labor for thy part as I do for mine. Therefore, dame, make thee ready, I warn thee anon, tomorrow with my lad to the plough thou shalt gone, and I will be housewife and keep our house at home, and take my ease as thou hast done by God and St. John. I grant, quoth the goodwife, as I understand, tomorrow in the morning I will be wakened, yet will I rise while ye be sleeping, and see that all things be ready laid to your hand. So it passed all for the morrow until it was daylight. The goodwife thought on her deed, and up she rose right. Dame, said the goodman, I swear by God's might, I will fetch home our beasts and help that you were dight, or ready. The goodman to the field hied him full yarn, or quickly. The goodwife made butter, her deeds were full dern, or secret. She took again the buttermilk and put it in the churn, and said that one pint shall be enough our sire to learn. Home come the goodman and took good keep, or observed, how the wife had laid her flesh for to steep, or marinate. She said, sir, all this day ye need not to sleep, keep well our children and let them not weep. If you go to the oven malt for to make, put small fire underneath, sir, for God's sake. The oven is low and dry, good tend that ye take, for if it fasten on a fire, it will be evil too black. There sit two geese abroad, keep them well from woe, and they may come to good, or that will wax sorrow. Dame, said the good man, hie thee to the plough, teach me no more housewifery, for I know enough. Forth went the good wife, courteous and hind, she called to her lad, and to the plough they wend. They were busy all day. A fit here I find, and if I had drunk once, ye shall hear the best behind, or that follows. So, that is where our text ends. It is incomplete in the manuscript, promising another fit or section if the audience provides the singer with another drink. In fact, there is a sliver more after the lines I concluded with. The manuscript does continue with, quote, a fit. Here beginneth another fit, the sooth for to say, and that's where it actually cuts off. And it's not that there's a missing page where the continuation existed. The writing ends with about a quarter or fifth of the page left blank at the bottom. So clearly the scribe just never finished the work. It's also the last item bound in this codex, which is a very miscellaneous collection of texts, ranging from saints' lives to knightly tales to a list of London wardens and bailiffs, one inclusion that maybe suggests this wasn't ultimately assembled in Yorkshire, but came together in London. And of course, we have the ballad at the end. The ballad is also in its own complete quire, or bundle of bound pages, on paper with a watermark not found on any of the other quires, and the scribe who wrote it down didn't write anything else in the collection, which is not atypical. 10 different hands are recognizable across 14 texts. So, as with many a medieval anthology, what we have is a bunch of what were probably independent booklets or fascicles that have been stuffed all together in one new binding. In fact, in this case, a new binding was put on in 1921, and the nature of the prior bindings of this collection seems not to have been well recorded. All the different handwriting dates to this same time frame, so these were probably gathered together sometime in the late 15th century, but there are signs, errors in early modern page numberings, for example, that they got unbound and shuffled around a bit by collectors in the intervening centuries. Where exactly the ballad came from, and why it was included, and why it was never finished, are unknown. It's frustrating, but at the same time, it's not too hard to predict where this story is headed. And even better than just our gut instincts for how a story with this premise would resolve, this tale has descendants in the folk tradition that we can use to fill out that final fit for us. This plot is given in the Arne Thompson Uther Index of Folk Tales as tale type 1408, the man who does his wife's work. And variations on this type are found in folk songs under such titles as Father Grumble, or Old Crumley, or John Grumley, or Women's Work, among other titles. And here's one simple version of that folk song, as preserved by the folk singer Sandy Patton, with the title The Old Man Who Lived in the Woods. Alas, I'm not prepared to sing it, but here are the words. There was an old man who lived in the woods, as you can plainly see, who said he could do more work in a day than his wife could do in three. If this be so, the old woman said, then this you must allow, that you will do my work for a day while I go drive the plow. But you must milk the tiny cow for fear that she go dry, and you must feed the little pigs that are within the sty, and you must watch the bracket hen lest she should lay astray, and you must wind the reel of yarn that I spun yesterday. The old woman took the staff in her hand and went to drive the plow. The old man took the pail in his hand and went to milk the cow. But Tiny hinched and Tiny flinched and Tiny cocked her nose, and Tiny gave the old man such a kick that the blood ran down to his toes. It's here, my good cow, and ho, my good cow, and now, my good cow, stand still. If ever I milk this cow again, 'twill be against my will. And then he fed the little pigs that were within the sty, but he bumped his head against a post, and how the blood did fly. And then he watched the bracket hen, lest she should lay astray, but he forgot the reel of yarn his wife spun yesterday. He swore by all the stars in heaven and all the leaves on the tree that his wife could do more work in a day than he could do in three. He swore by all the leaves on the tree and all the stars in heaven that his wife could do more work in a day than he could do in seven. I love a folk song, especially one frequently performed as a children's song, that prominently features blood gushing from wounds. You just don't hear that too often in Raffi or The Wiggles, I assume. I haven't listened to much modern children's music. My favorite song when I was 5-6 years old was Sweet Dreams Are Made of This by The Eurythmics. So, you know what? Actually, there was a children's album I loved called Our Dinosaur Friends by Pam Johnson, Wayne Parker, and Eric Miller, released in 1978. It included the lyric, "Mean and cruel was Tyrannosaurus Rex, caught his victims by their necks." Great stuff. And thanks, Mom. And that's sincere, by the way. I feel like I was raised in a wonderful stew of interesting things. There's a notion floating around that 80s children were all traumatized by all the gruesome pop culture we consumed. I saw Gremlins in the theater when I was 6. I loved it. It was my favorite movie. Kind of still is, deep down, though there are certainly movies I admire more these days. I had a plush Gizmo that was my number one stuffed animal. I had the set of Gremlins storybook records. It was a touchstone piece of culture for me. I'm not trying to do a rant on kids' culture has gotten too soft or anything like that, but I personally am grateful for having been allowed to experience all that dark and weird culture. I probably would not be making this show if it weren't for having a mother who read The Shining out loud in the car on long family vacations and would rent Alien and Creepshow and The Name of the Rose and not send her preteen child out of the room. I understand that wouldn't work for all children, but I think it worked for me. I think I'm reasonably well adjusted today, not despite those things, but at least in part because of them. So once again, happy Mother's Day, Mom, and to all the other weird moms out there, you know who you are. Our riddle for this episode is a bit of folklore collected by David Fitzgerald in Limerick in the early 19th century. It's certainly older than that. It has Latin antecedents, but I'm going with this slightly more modern formulation. Here it is. A vessel of gold with a handle out, the son of a king took a drink thereout. Yet from no tree crown and from no tree butt, from no tree of the world was its substance cut, nor smith nor brazier fashioned it out. So, what does a prince drink from that is not made of wood nor shaped by a human metalworker? The answer is a woman's breast. If you would like more information about the texts and sources for this episode, including links to the images of the original manuscript, you can find that in the episode post on our website, medievaldeathtrip.com. And you can email me there to patrick@medievaldeathtrip.com. We are also scattered across the increasingly fragmented and rather unmanageable social media landscape, so maybe find us on Instagram @medievaldeathtrip or on Blue Sky as @medievaldeathtrip.bsky.social and @medievaldeathtrip@medievalist.masto.host on Mastodon. You can also support the show on Patreon, which will get you access to bonus content such as appendices of extra material for some episodes and a full audiobook of Jordanus's Wonders of the East, which I think makes a great road trip option as vacation season approaches. I'd like to thank our most recent new returning and upgrading patrons, John, Maya, and Lindsay. Thank you so much for your support and correspondence. Today, you can all also be honorary matrons. And if anyone would like to join them, you can find us on Patreon by searching for Medieval Death Trip or going straight to patreon.com/mdtpodcast. And that brings us to the end of the show. Happy Mother's Day. May the division of labor in your household be equitable and satisfying. And thanks for listening.